Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel.
Here's Cortinel.
Each week they unleash their raw, stripped down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Here we go again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with me, Jungle Jim Jerome, and of course, Russ Cortinel, who's hiding away for the summer in Idaho, in the beautiful Gaza Ranch. Rusty, how are you?
I'm good. I'm getting better now. It doesn't get old.
It never gets old, Rusty. It never gets old. The snapping of the White Claw. This is a special edition. A surprise guest, Russ, which I'm totally thrilled about. Pat, don't call me Burrell. Call me Burl, like squirrel. Right? Professional
That's
baseball
right.
player.
That's
Did
right.
I get that right, Pat?
You got it.
Boy, it's great to have you on, man. Thanks for doing this. Great career from, you got drafted in 98, as you just told me, and started playing in 2000, right through to 2011.
Yeah.
And of course, the big highlight, World Series in 2008 and with Philly, and then 2010 in San Francisco, and got to be the thrill of a lifetime. What are you doing now, Pat? You're finished playing baseball. What's up for you now?
Yeah, you know, I got done playing, like you said, in 11. I stayed around and did some scouting for the Giants, for Bochy, and stepped away from that in 15 and really haven't been doing a whole lot. Did some TV locally for the Giants, and then this year got an opportunity to coach, which I hadn't done, and the A-ball affiliate for the Giants is in San Jose, and it's very convenient for where we live. And so I jumped at the chance, and then obviously spent about 7 days in spring training. They sent everybody home. So I don't think there's going to be a minor league season, unfortunately, this year. But I was really looking forward to it. But what are you going to do?
Where are you from, Pat? Take us through your baseball career, where it all started for you.
From the Bay Area, California. And then went to college in Miami and, you know, spent the next 10 years or so in Philadelphia, but grew up in the Bay Area.
Well, listen, here's what we're going to do today, and and I love this. So I threw it out there earlier in the week, Rusty, my boy, for people to, I guaranteed them a shout out. It's called pathetic begging, Pat, okay? That's what we have to do to get our listeners, okay? We've got to plead with them. Get on my knees.
Well, you got the right guy. No one listens to me anyways.
Yeah, exactly. And said, listen, give us your thoughts, questions, comments for Russ. And I got a ton. I got a ton of them. I leafed through them this afternoon. I thought this will be awesome because we can get Russ's perspective on things. And then we can get you to react to some of this stuff if you're cool with that.
Sure.
It's interesting that...
That's Pat's dog in the background.
Is that okay?
She's jealous.
So he's got a new house. They're doing some renovations, so he's moved in for the next 3 days, and we've got a couple dogs with us.
That's nice.
Yeah.
You know, when I hear that dog, Pat, it reminds me of my ex-girlfriend.
That's about right.
Rusty, the last show I did, you know, I do the Ottawa podcast with our producer, Steve, who's back in Ottawa, who does this show for us. And one of the questions, Rusty, which we tackled at the end of the show, and it was cause for pause when I hit Stevie with it, and I'm sure we've had some response to it. You know, in your career, Russ, I know, of course, that you had a long, illustrious career, as most people do. And you didn't get a chance. You had a chance to win the Stanley Cup, but you didn't. And as much as we joke about that, that's the fact. And there were Hall of Fame inductions this week or this past month, Russ, with Kevin Lowe, of course, from here, who got in, and others. And then closer to home in Ottawa, the Canadian Football League, Pat, is alive and well here. It's our NFL, and Henry Burris got in on a first ballot. And it brought up the question, Russ, if you had to pick in your career at the end of it, would you rather win a Stanley Cup or would you rather end up in the Hall of Fame? And you can't have both.
It's an easy question. I'd rather win a Stanley Cup. I think absolutely every kid that plays any sport, you make it to the professional level, you want to win a championship. The Hall of Fame is a great recognition for any player, but I would want to be known as a Stanley Cup champion. And sure, the Hall of Fame is great, but that's what I would personally want.
How about you, Pat?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, the Hall of Fame was such a stretch to begin with in the baseball world. I'm sure in the same as hockey. But, you know, Russ touched on it, and it's the team concept where, you know, I can remember back in the Philadelphia days, we had a lot of high draft picks, and the people that were making these decisions hit on some guys. And what we did was we built a winner, built kind of a dynasty there. You know, they won the one championship, but there's about 5 years there where they were considered probably the best team out there. And, you know, that doesn't happen without the camaraderie of the guys. You know, there's actually one up here in Gaza Ranch, and, you know, Shane Victorino is a new member, and, you know, we played golf the other day, and, you know, all we did was talk about that 2008 year. We played together for more than that, you know, more years than that, but the championship year, we talked more about that than anything, and that's because it worked out. I mean, it's when you're the last... You know, the last man standing, it's something that, you know, they just can't take away from you. Obviously, the Hall of Fame is incredible, but it's really hard to get, you know, those 25 guys moving in the right direction, and it's pretty meaningful.
Yeah, right on. Boy, it's nice to have someone intelligent on the show. that's great, man. I might have a gig for you, Pat.
Wife's a lawyer. I got to watch my ass.
Okay. You did a little TV, didn't you, said, Pat? What happened there? How was that experience?
You know, I was doing the pre and post game for the Giants, and there was a team of us, so it wasn't steady. I would do, you know, a couple weeks here and there, and I enjoyed it. The hard part is, you know, watching the game and then the post game show. It's a long day.
Right.
And it's, you know, for me, it was on a team that wasn't playing very well. You know, you don't want to be critical either, but you know, you got to. Right.
But don't want to be honest.
You right. Can't, yeah, and that's right. And you also don't want to come across as, you know, back when I played and all that stuff. And
right.
So I think there's people that are kind of built for it. I'm not sure I was one of them.
Right.
I kind of think the coaching would have been great if that had worked out this year.
One of the guys Russ played with, he's been in the news again this week, Jeremy Roenick, who was a great player in the NHL, retired, and then he started doing a gig for NBC, and then he was popping on podcasts as well. He was a color guy with NBC, and then he went on a podcast, and I'm paraphrasing here, and said... He was on a holiday with this really hot chick from NBC and his wife, and he said something like, if I was ever going to have a threesome, fuck, he got fired on the spot from NBC. Yeah. And now, Russ, he's suing them.
Yeah, I read that.
What do you think, Rusty? Should he or not, or what? What's your take?
Well, I don't know. It's tough today. You say the wrong thing or post the wrong thing or... You know, associate yourself with the wrong person, then, you know, they take your job away. So he, I don't know. Right. I'm not a lawyer. Probably Boo, if she was here. If Boo was here, Pat's wife, she could tell us if he has a case or not. But I really don't know.
Well, we'll have to wait and see. Did you ever get in trouble, Pat, saying anything on air? Did they ever step in?
No, I mean, the one thing comes to mind, there was... I mean, we're kind of putting the pedal down here, but the Philadelphia media, you know, it's tough in the, you know, the football team, the baseball team. I don't know if the hockey team there, if the media is really tough, but It's insanity, yeah. And one of the reporters had done something, and one of our guys was upset, and I'm in the shower, and somebody ran in, Greg Dobbs ran in and said, hey, you got to get out there, man. One of our players is about to go after this beat writer. And I go, why don't you do it? I'm naked. He goes, I can't. So I come running out there, and I got nothing on. I had to jump on the player's back, you know, and pull him away. And he's popping off to the beat writer, and it's, you know, I was hoping he wouldn't take a swing at him. And next thing you know, he goes, holy shit, Pat, you're fucking naked. And I was. But we were playing good. I didn't want any shit to happen.
That's great.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. That's a show right there, Rusty. We can go now. We'll talk to everyone next week.
That's so good.
Fantastic.
We had a story similar to that, but a little bit different, involving the media. We're in Montreal, and you could see into the shower from the locker room through this door, and the media of Montreal is crazy for hockey. So this one guy was sitting there watching a shower every day, like just sitting there looking right at us, not covering, not interviewing, not writing anything down, just staring at us. So
was he sizing you guys up?
Yeah, I think so.
How'd you fare?
So Mike, not great. Mike Keane goes out, grabs a chair, grabs him by the back of his hair, and brings him right into the shower and sits him down and goes, this is where you want to be. So just sit right here. We never saw the guy again. We think he had a fake media pass.
Oh, that's funny, man.
We never saw him again.
Oh, man.
He's staring at all the guys showering.
I think the... that's awesome. I think the Oilers... you'd remember Terry Jones, Rusty, when you were playing. He was a writer for the Sun Chain. And he pissed off a bunch of guys with some article he wrote about the game or something the night before, and they invited him into the dressing room and threw him into the hot tub.
Oh, God.
And said, keep writing bad things.
Yeah, that wouldn't work today.
Did the media ever travel with the teams?
Yeah. Yeah, they did. And then Harold Ballard had a fight with the media because they wanted to allow women into the locker room, and he didn't. And there was a big kerfuffle over it, and he banned them from traveling with us. So they used to charter with us, and then after that, they had to fly commercial. So they were pissed off.
Don't you think that when they do travel with the team, it's a lot better for that stuff? Like, things get kind of handled internally instead of, you know, they're not going to, it goes both ways, but we found that, you know, when they had to travel with us and sit next to us on the planes,
to know you a little better then, as a human.
You know,
being.
It softened some of the articles a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
What we did in Vancouver was we took a guy to Vegas, and we had all broke curfew, and he was with us. So after that, he knew he had to be one of us, or we were going to throw him under the bus.
Yeah.
Tell me, boys, Russ, when you bring it up, did you play Russ when they first allowed women into the locker rooms? Was it your whole career? And tell me about the first time someone must have dropped trowel by mistake when there was
guys, I have to say, guys would walk in and around the locker room with, you know, with or without a towel, and I think a lot of guys were like, look, if they want to come in our locker room, then they have to accept what they're going to see. And so, you know, some players are respectful, and other players were like, well, it's not my fault. I'm not worried about it.
Right.
So, and the women were, I found all the women that came in the locker room, you know, were looking you in the eyes, not looking around the room. So who knows?
I like,
well, there was nothing for them to see when it came to me, so they always looked me in the eye.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, the thing is, imagine how uncomfortable they must feel, you know. And so it was kind of during my era when that started happening. And, you know, there's adjustment like anything else, but I found that all the women were very professional.
Yeah, me too.
You know.
When we did interviews, we always had a towel on or a robe, but I'm talking about in the background. when a guy's walking from the shower to the medical room or to his clothes, that's what I'm talking about. But interviews, everybody had towels on or right. t-shirts or, you know, we were covered. So
there was a Pat in the NHL and the great Oilers teams with Gretzky and the lads, Dave Semenko, God rest his soul. He died too young a couple years ago. He was very quotable, and someone asked him because one of the female reporters apparently said, it's a little unfair that these guys are walking around naked, you know, when we're in there. And they asked Semenko about that, and he said, I agree, it's completely unfair, you know, that the guys are naked. And to make it fair, the women should be naked. So some of our questions we got, Rusty, another one, Neil Fernie. Thanks, Neil. Big fan of the show. We've talked about a bunch of stuff in your life, Russ, but this question comes up. Why did you retire when you did, Russ?
Well, I got retired. I mean, I was training that summer to re-sign. And I had a couple offers that were low-ball offers to move. And I just... some new teams that had just entered the league, and I just wasn't willing to move my family. My oldest daughter started kindergarten. Lawton was in preschool. We're living in California. And I was just mentally, I was tired, and so I didn't get a contract that was suitable for what I thought I should get, and so I just, no one was interested in signing me for what I wanted. So
right.
I did try to go to Detroit because they had a great team, and I was hoping to win a championship with them, but they were loaded. So I would have gone there for a lot less money, but anyways, it didn't happen. So
right.
It wasn't like I finished the season and said, okay, I'm retiring. And Cam Neely told me this. He goes, 99.9% of athletes don't retire. They get retired. So, mm-hmm. It's either injuries or your plays declined, but not too many guys like Gretz go, okay, I'm done now. I'm going to quit at the end of the year.
Right.
That doesn't usually happen too often.
Pat, you're in a sport where contracts led the way, lucrative contracts. You played after 2000. What was your deal, Pat, when it came time to finish up playing the game, when you did retire?
Yeah,
walk us through that.
A little bit of a combination of both. You know, I had had a foot problem that I had cleaned up in 04, 05, and it's a degenerative joint called the navicular joint in my arch. And if baseball... if you went to third base first and went to second, I would have been fine. It's the left turns that used to really bother me. And when they cleaned it out, it was just a matter of time before the next step was going to be to have to fuse that joint, and then it would really affect things later. So I just played that 2010 season, and we were fortunate enough to win, and then... I didn't want to go anywhere else. Fortunately, the Giants brought me back, mm-hmm. and about halfway through the year, the foot just couldn't take anymore. So I stayed on the team to help out some of the young guys for the remainder of the year. But everybody involved kind of knew it was a wrap. It was going to be, that was it for me. And that's when I kind of decided to stay on and help out in another way, which I think was, I was pretty fortunate to get that opportunity, but for me, it was just over.
A reminder, the Suspendables are engaged on Facebook. Your comments are welcome always.
I was going to ask this question about, some guy wanted to know, Russ, did you ever have a stick sponsorship deal, Russ, when you played in the NHL?
Yeah, actually Sherwood paid me to use their sticks, and it was great in Montreal because we were close to the factories, and Montreal being Montreal, with all the high profile of being a player there, we got paid for skates, gloves, and sticks. It wasn't a ton of money, but at that time it was to us, and so we had this one guy, Steve Martinson, and yep. the stick reps would come around, and whoever was using their sticks at Christmas, they'd give you money.
Right.
So he had ordered 3 different patterns from 3 different companies. And he'd ask the trainer which guy was coming that day. And he'd be using their sticks at practice, and the guy would give him a few $1,000. And then next practice, it'd be the other guy from Sherwood. And he had it down pat. It was freaking hilarious.
That's funny, so, man.
Now, dude, how different are sticks between players? I mean, significant?
Yeah, significant. Like, I used Sherwood most of my career, and there was Canadian, Coho, Christian, Titan, and then came Easton. Got into hockey. And I was so particular with the feel of the stick, and I used a wooden stick at the time.
Right.
That I tried to switch, and I always went back to Sherwood. It was right for me.
So the other companies, no matter how hard they tried, they couldn't replicate what you had in that one?
Yeah, it wasn't duplicated.
That's because the difference.
There was fiberglass involved, and mm-hmm. thickness, and the wood. And then some of the companies painted the sticks. At one point, Sherwood wanted me to use this brand that it was a different number. Like, I used 70-30, and I don't know what they wanted me to use. Maybe I was using a 50-30, but they wanted me to use a 70-30 to hope sell more sticks to kids or something. I don't know.
Right.
So they painted my stick black and then put a fake number on it that I wasn't using. Like, under the paint was a different stick. But so that it was that was their way of marketing this new brand of stick that I wasn't using. So
that's funny. Speaking of Samick, he always said that Sherwood paid him $10,000 a year not to use their sticks. How about you, Pat? Were there any big endorsement deals for you individually?
I was always interested about the hockey sticks. With the baseball bats, you know, when I started, Louisville Slugger had the market share, and everybody that I can remember signed a, you know, like a lifelong contract with Louisville. And then the actual wood that the company started using, when Barry Bonds went to the Maple, it really changed everything for the players. Most everybody stopped using the ash wood and went to Maple. And then a bunch of companies came out, and I ended up using Mariucci, which were phenomenal.
Mariucci? I've never heard of that.
Mariucci, yeah. Mariucci, they're out of, the guys are out of LSU, so they're down in Louisiana. And when I got those bats, all we cared about was how hard they were and how the ball came off.
Right.
And everybody was different, the different lengths, the different weights. But when I got those Mariucci bats, when I went back to the Louisville Slugger, it felt like I was swinging a wet paper bag. I mean, it just, the balls were coming off so hard. It's kind of like the PXG irons.
Wow. Right.
You know, it's just a different, I don't know how they make them. I have no idea. I've never been a part of that process, but, you know, right. It was a different sound. And
What kind of cash would you make back then for
I didn't, I never had a deal with the bat companies. They made them for me for free.
Yep.
But I didn't get a cash deal. I don't know that guys had cash with the bats.
Mm-hmm.
The merchandise was a different story. You know, depending on the player, Nike was a big one. You know, you'd get this catalog that it would just be Christmas for the whole family. I mean, you'd order everything you possibly could. And then Mizuno was popular because it coupled with Cabela, I think. Is that the name of the store?
Yeah,
sure.
So these guys were hunters and fishermen, they cleaned up, you know.
Cool. Rusty's answered this question before, so I'll ask you, Pat. A guy wants to know, Ty is his name, T-I-E. Thanks, Ty. Rusty says, have you ever snuck out after curfew? I think I probably know that answer. I guess you go first, Russ. Have you ever?
Well, we were in Quebec.
Yeah.
And Shane Churla was with us, and there was Neil Broughton, Paul Broughton, four of us were out, and we stayed a little late, later than we were supposed to. So we went back for curfew, snuck out after curfew, and then came back. And Shane Churla, we left him. He went to the washroom or something, and we left him there. And he came back to our room, and he was yelling at Neil and I, going, "You freaking assholes, you freaking left me at the fucking bar." And he goes, "My wallet, did you at least bring my wallet back?" And we're like, "What wallet?" And he goes, "Ah, fuck." So he had to sneak out again to go find his wallet. And he found it. We were in a booth, and he found it in the booth. So
lucky find.
But we had a couple times where we, as a team, we were trying to stand up to the coach.
Right.
And I was a young kid in Toronto, and they had just taken the captaincy away from Rick Vive. Yeah. And so we were like, no, we're all going to stay out. So I stayed out.
Like a protest. Almost.
Yeah, a protest. So I stay out 15 minutes after curfew. We didn't have a game the next night. Coach was being a dick, Dan Maloney.
Right.
And I go, okay, and I snuck out of the bar, and I think I was a rookie that year. Went back to my hotel room, and Kenny Raggett and L.A. Afraidy had done something to the phone in the elevator of the hotel. So I sneak back into my room, and who's in my room but the coach checking curfew because he got a call that someone pulled the phone out of the fucking elevator. So I got busted, and Brad Motor City Smitty had to protect me because Satch was his nickname, came right after me. Two big men wrestling in my room, and I'm taking off my leather tie at the time and jumped in the bed while they were fighting. I didn't know what to do. I
was leather tie. 19
years old. I was shitting my pants.
As you can tell by now, Pat, we don't like to talk. We don't like to talk stats, man. We like to talk stories. So what do you got for us?
Oh, the stats. You can find those on the back of the card. Mm-hmm. Two things popped into my mind, and then a bunch of others I probably can't talk about. But we didn't have... Once you got to the major leagues, there wasn't a curfew.
What?
There just wasn't. Minor leagues, we had one, and I had slidden into home plate, and the catcher jumped up to catch the ball, and he came down, and his cleat went into my joint capsule, my knee.
Yikes.
Yeah, but it wasn't bad, and I just had to... they were worried about infection, you know, so because the metal spike, and so I was in a little air cast, and I was in double A, and so there was a curfew, and... It was a Friday. I couldn't play for a couple of games or maybe more, maybe a week. But it was a Friday night, and we were somewhere, and the streets were calling, man. And I had to get out of there, but I knew I couldn't get anything going with that brace. So I left the brace on the hotel room bed. And when the coach came in, I'm supposed to be in this brace all the time, of course. So he knew I wasn't there. And then not only did I got double punishment because I'd left the brace that was keeping me out of the games in the room. Yep. So I could play one game, but I couldn't play the one that counted. This goes to show you about the difference in, you know, the minor leagues and the major leagues. I was a rookie, like Russ was talking about, and we had just left Chicago and bussed up to Milwaukee for another series. And there was a group of guys that had some unfinished business apparently in Chicago. So, I don't think it's more than a couple, maybe an hour away. And so when the game got over Milwaukee, there was a limo out front and they said, "We're going back." And I go, "Shit, I'll go." Well, we come back, and it's, you know, it's getting light out, and, you know, we play at 7 o'clock at night, so, you know, right. It was, but one of the guys had to pee so bad, and we're downtown Milwaukee, and he pulls over, and he starts peeing, and one of those bike policemen, you know, that on the, maybe even perfect. On a Segway or something, he pulls him over, and you know, he's worried because he's got a bunch of stuff in his pockets. He's throwing all that stuff into the deal. I don't have a shirt on, and I come limping into the hotel room, and the staff's having breakfast in the lobby, and I'm walking by with no shirt.
Oh, no.
And I'm thinking, man, this is a rookie. Can you imagine? So I had to head down at BP at batting practice. You know, I'm kind of, you know, I'm not saying much. I'm worried that, you know, they're going to say something. I mean, I've been there for a couple of weeks, and I'm, you know, strolling into the lobby at 6 a.m. And he goes, was it worth it? You know, I mean, the coach, wow. Man, Terry Francona, yeah. That's he goes, funny. Well, you know, most of these guys are out there married, so I hope it was worth it for you. And that's all he said, and he walked away. So I said, should I better hit a homer, you know?
Yeah, better hit a dinger or two. Yeah, that's funny. Rusty, you've had your Rusty's a great prankster, by the way, Pat. So if you hang around him long enough, okay, you're going to fear for your life if he starts to prank you. He's pulled a lot, Rusty, and we got someone here asking us today if what's the worst prank, Russ, that someone's pulled on you, if you can remember.
Oh.
Okay, how about you, Pat? Russ is blanking here.
We had one that made, I don't know about in Canada, but it made all the headlines in spring training. It was the Phillies, and we had a guy named Kyle Kendrick, and he had pitched for us the year before in the second half, and I think he won 10 games, and he pitched his ass off, and he had earned a rotation spot for us, and they decided they were going to get him, and they had the general manager, the manager of the team, Charlie Manuel at the time, all the players in on this, and they brought him in the office and said that he had been traded to Japan. And this kid, I mean, they had all the important decision makers were in the room, which maybe was a little over the top, but. I mean, the kid broke down, you know. He goes, I don't want to go to Japan. And, of course, you know, I was involved because I had known a buddy who had the same last name, long story short, and I was trying to get this kid to sign my jersey for this guy. And or his jersey, sorry, for my buddy. And I come out there, and he's all shaken up. He's on the phone with his agent. He can't believe it. He's getting whacked, and he's going to Japan. I'm like, you got traded to Japan? I said, shit, well, you better sign this jersey before you go.
I was playing in the Stanley Cup Final with Montreal, and it's beautiful weather, spring weather, Montreal, and I was my apartment was I was going to lease it out to a baseball player, which I did every summer. So on a day off in between games against Calgary, I went to the store and I got a couple boxes. So I'm walking by the Forum, and Jacques Laperriere sees me with these boxes, our assistant coach, and he says, what are you doing? I go, I'm just putting some stuff away, and I got the storage bin downstairs. And he goes, oh, okay. During the playoffs, we practiced at 4 o'clock, and then we had a team dinner upstairs in the Forum after, and our GM was always there, Serge Savard. Mm-hmm. He comes over to me before we go upstairs after practice. He goes, Serge is pissed off because you don't think we can win, and you're already boxing up your apartment. And he is livid that you don't think we can win. So at the dinner, I'm 23 years old. I go flying over to his table. He's got a nice glass of red wine going there, sitting around there enjoying dinner. We had great food. And I go, Serge, I want to win the Stanley Cup more than anybody on this team. I haven't won one. All these guys have won one. He goes, Russ, I know that. He goes, well, I wasn't packing up my apartment because I didn't think we were going to win. And there's Jacques Laperriere just
laughing his ass off.
And he goes, in French, he goes, I got to tell you, so you know something. Yeah. But and they started freaking laughing their asses off at me, but I was sweating from I couldn't hold it back. I have to go over and apologize to the GM. And anyways, that was an embarrassing moment. All the guys are looking at me like, what the fuck is going on with Rusker? Looks like he's going to cry.
With his leather tie.
Yeah, with my no, I didn't have leather ties by then. That was
you're out of that. Thanks a lot to Dave Michaud. Let's see, Mike Hines and Kevin McNamara. And I think it's B.E. Oot. Dave Hemming has weighed in. And Mike Sheremet, thanks a lot. Brian Lowe wants to know your favorite cigar, Russ.
Monte Cristo number 2.
Yeah. You a smoker, Pat? Are you doing the cigars on the course?
No, when I was drinking, I'd smoke cigarettes, those American Spirit Yellows.
Beautiful.
I just fired away.
Listen, I've known Russ a long time, okay? And I've been sober, clean and sober. August 1st, I'll be 10 years. And if you can make it with Russ, okay?
We're doing great.
Yeah.
You got a story similar to that, Pat?
Sure.
If you don't mind talking about it?
No, I don't mind. I haven't on anything before, but it's really been great. You know, things started, I just started losing control of it. And, you know, we got some family history of alcoholism, and I just really got to the point where it was time to make a change. And fortunately, I reached out, got some help. And like Russ said, it's, you know, May 7th, and so things have gone well. But, you know, definitely during that first period, you know, some tough times, but, you know, it's really been great.
Good for you, man. And of course, you wouldn't be immune to it in major sports and in pro ball. Must have been all around you when you played, Pat.
Oh, it was a race to the tap. I mean, we had Budweiser and Bud Light, and they were just big kegs, and they had pitchers, and there was a line when the, fortunately for me, at the
was
end
that
of my,
in the locker room?
Yeah, yeah.
You lucky bastards.
Oh, Jesus, we had, nice. It was loaded. I mean, you were loaded before the plane.
Yeah.
And I got taken out of the game. For defensive replacement at the end of my career, so it started a little bit earlier for me. There were stories about guys that had nerves, you know, and were anxious, and have a half a beer every inning, you know. They'd come in and take a couple slugs, and nice. I didn't have that, but when it was over, it was over. And so in baseball, you know, you get taken out of the game, you can't go back in. So.
Right. Right.
I mean, I'd try to get a nice little coating going before the real stuff started after. A little head start.
Sure, a real listener. Yeah.
Wasn't there a story about some pitchers?
Yeah.
They were drinking in the bullpen or whatever. Like, they knew they weren't playing, so they were having
starting,
a couple beers.
Yeah, started.
This is public knowledge.
This is great.
Sure. Yeah. No, I didn't. That happened. And they just got caught.
Yeah,
and it was Boston, and the media is crazy. And if they're not winning, things like that come out. And but you know, that I saw that quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're not playing.
Yeah.
You know, it's 5 o'clock.
Have at her, man.
Cut loose.
And you know, go to the ballpark to have a beer and a hot dog, right? Whether you're playing or not.
I mean, all those fans are doing. You might as well join them.
So here's another one we got. My buddy, Peter Whitewich, huge fan of the show, lives in my hometown in Sudbury, and he's been looking after his brother Eddie for a long time. Eddie tells us not to swear so much. And hey, Eddie. And he wants to know, Rusty, who was your most favorite / hated referee or linesman when you played? And tell us about that.
Oh, Carrie Frazier and I battled all the time. I don't know what it was, but he didn't like me, and I didn't like him. And I actually talked to him on the phone this year for the first time since I retired, and he's got some business that he's dealing with. And And it was really funny talking to him because, man, for 16 years, I couldn't stand that guy and he couldn't stand me. And,
right.
And I remember he disliked me so much that this tough guy was trying to get at me, and I'm not a fighter. So they, either the players or the refs were in between us, and this guy wanted to kill me. I don't know why, but...
I can tell you why.
Yeah. And Kerry goes, no, let them go. Like, you fucking asshole. Like, this guy's going to kill me.
So
and thank
you.
God the ref, it must have been the linesman.
Yeah.
And when it was a non-fighter, they would kind of hold, the linesman would get in there and hold you off or hold the guy off and say, you know, settle down. Well, no, let him go. I mean, he called back two goals that I scored.
Oh,
that,
no.
But we didn't have video replay. And he freaking did it on purpose. Uh-oh. For sure. He's like, I remember scoring a goal in Detroit. And they're like, it didn't go in, Kerry. It didn't go in. And he looks at me and goes, no, it did not. And I'm like, tonight on ESPN, you're going to watch that. You're going to watch the news tonight and the replays, and you're going to see that I just scored that goal. And he goes, no, I didn't see it go in. And
right.
He just looked at me with that smirk on his face.
You little prick, yeah. Kerry. You little prick.
And then there was a French-Canadian ref. Can't remember his last name right off top. But when I got traded from Montreal, it was a big controversy because I asked to be traded. And it wasn't pretty. And so I came back from my first game, and some fans were cheering. Some fans were booing.
Right.
And he called a penalty against me, and all I said was, oh, I wish you were a homer when I played here. And he goes, 10 minutes.
Oh,
give me 10 minutes. I didn't even swear at him. So I'm sitting in the box, my first game back for 12 minutes. Frick, I had a shitty game. It's terrible.
You must have been trying to think how you're going to get...
Morrell was the...
Morrell. Yeah.
Denny Morrell.
Did you ever get back at him, Rusty? Fraser?
No, because how do you do that?
I mean, right, unless you go on the media, chirp him or something. So, Pat, it's become the sexy thing in the world of sports these days to mic up players. You know, they started in the NFL, I think, that started doing it with the quarterbacks and stuff like that. And I have always wondered, Pat, if you're going to mic up a player, let's mic up the batter and the ump. On a bad call, of course you played.
Yeah.
What you must have a story or two about an ump that you absolutely fucking hated.
Oh man. God, there was just so many. You know, I think the best thing that's happened in baseball was the guy Galarraga threw a perfect game in. I guess it was Detroit and. Jim Joyce missed the call at first for the last out of the game. Do you guys remember that?
Yep.
And he went out and apologized, and he was emotional about it. He knew he missed it.
Oh, I remember that.
And he was humble. He was vulnerable about it. And I wish those kinds of things happened more, and unfortunately they just don't. But if you ask the players... 100% the guys, he's probably their favorite umpire just because he did make the mistake and he owned up to it and it bothered him. And it cost that kid a perfect game and they can't change it. But
right.
We had some, there's a guy, Angel Hernandez, that this story I was going to tell, I left Philadelphia, and I went to Tampa Bay, and I went to Tampa Bay because there was some hope that being a veteran, I could help out some of the young players. One of those players was Evan Longoria, ended up being a really good player. And now he's actually in San Francisco. But back then, we had gone to dinner, and the umpire crew came into the restaurant, and I said, hey, man, this is an opportunity. I'll do it, but I'll tell them it's from you. So we sent over a very expensive bottle of wine to the table, and I paid for it, but it was from him, it was a deal where it was a good thing. And so naturally these guys come over after to thank him, and they thank me. I think they kind of winked. They knew probably it came from me, but they understood what was going on. And I just remember saying, you know, this kid's so good, he doesn't need any help tomorrow, but I'm gonna. Yeah. You know, it was kind of a joke.
Right, right.
And I was joking too, but it turns out the next night in the crucial part of the game, I did a check swing on a two-strike pitch, and they point down to Angel Hernandez, who received the bottle of wine. And this fucker, he crow hops out, and he punches me out, and I'm yelling at him across the... And now I got thrown out of the game.
Sure.
And I'm like, you could take that bottle of wine and shove it up your ass. You know what I mean? I mean, it was... I said, you know, it wasn't even... You know, the check swing is like, did he go? And it's either yes or no. It's not a full-fledged 360-degree hop and just chainsaw the guy.
Yeah.
He made it pretty dramatic. And then, of course, I lost it. And then I was gone. And they asked me after the game. And I said, you know, shouldn't have bought that fucking bottle of wine.
You must have thought, yeah, I'm good here. I hit the guy with a nice bottle of bubbly the night before, or a bottle of wine. Let's see, Rusty, who else we have? Peter, yeah, thanks. Daryl Folds. Jeff Goyette has asked Rusty, who's the toughest guy you ever played against? And Pat, you can think about the toughest pitcher that you ever had to come up against. How about you, Rusty? Toughest guy that you hated to play against?
There's a few. I mean, Bob Probert was a mean dude. He didn't mind hitting me or anybody else, but as long as I was with Wendell Clark, he was, you know, he would take care of him if needed. But Probert was a really tough son of a gun. And, you know, he played real hard, this guy. And he was tough. He looked after Steve Yzerman and scored a lot of goals. So he was a valuable player. And he battled with a lot of demons himself. And he's since passed on, but we're the same age. And I'd say Probert in my era was the toughest guy I played against, but the best, in my opinion, was Wendell Clark. Before he hurt his back, he was the toughest guy in that era.
Someone else asked Russ further. They know Salming is your mentor.
Yeah.
Because you've talked about it in several shows, and some guy has asked here today, who else, Russ, were mentors of yours growing up?
Probably Gretz. Gretz is... been a life mentor and a hockey mentor for me. We've been friends a long time. I was with him today on the golf course watching him play, and just, he's such a great human being. So I'd have to say Wayne was the biggest impact for me, both on and off the ice.
Pat, toughest guy you had to hit against?
Man, I can tell you, you see him all the time now. He does commentating and analysts and plays a lot of golf. John Smoltz.
Oh, sure. With Atlanta. Yeah.
Yeah, we were in the same division there, Philly and Atlanta, for forever. And this is going to sound amazing, but I had two hits against him in that span of 9 years. They were 7 years apart.
Oh, Jesus.
So you're talking about 18 games a year. I got a chance to face this guy. And I just couldn't see the slider. I mean, he threw so hard, and his mechanics were perfect. And it was 96-mile-an-hour fastball and a 90-mile-an-hour slider, and they both came out the exact same. And then one took a left.
Yeah,
and I couldn't see it. I kept swinging at it. I mean, I swung at that son of a bitch. I still swing at it today if he came by me. And then, you know, of course, I leave Philadelphia and I go to Tampa, and he gets out of his contract in Atlanta and he goes to Boston. And I go, fuck, man, are you following me?
I love that. Guy spent 7 years trying to hit his pitch, swinging away.
Oh, dude, it was ugly.
Did you ever have to? Did you ever step into one, Pat, to get intentionally hit? Did you ever, fuck? I watched that game. I'm going, Jesus, man! You don't know how lethal that fastball is.
No. There's guys, and they talk about this, but there's Chase Utley's one of them, where the pitch comes and his instinct isn't to move; it's actually to go into it to protect him.
Jesus.
And it makes a little bit of sense, but my instinct, that I was out of there. I mean, I got plunked a couple times, you know, for guys hitting home runs or some showboat stuff. They'd go after the bigger guy. And, you know, that's one thing, but you can kind of feel when it's intentional, but if it's just a mistake, I was out of the way.
Right. Of course, hockey is renowned and notorious for fighting. Baseball to a lesser degree, but when they do have one, they're pretty good. Did you ever get in a mixer? Were you ever in
We had quite a few.
he was naked in the locker room.
Yeah. I saved one there. Yeah, no shit. We had one in the playoffs, Russ. And hold on, I want to hear the sound.
Russ is getting another.
Yeah, he's getting into it. And maybe it wasn't the playoffs. But remember how I mentioned that in the seventh inning, if we were up, if we were winning, they'd put a guy out in left field to play defense for me because that player was obviously a lot faster.
Right.
And I wasn't moving around so good. And so, you know, I would always go up to the clubhouse, take my cleats off, put on my turf shoes.
Sure.
And probably throw down a couple of cold Bud Lights. And then watch the rest of the game. You know?
Sure, why not?
Well, this particular night, I remember, you know, there was some shit going on, and we drilled somebody, and I think it was Victorino, actually. And next thing you know, I'm running out onto the field, and I'm not with it. I mean, I'm not even close to with it.
Right.
And somebody grabs me from behind, and they go, "Jesus Christ, you smell like beer." I go, "Well, fuck, I'm out of the game."
You had a little jag on. You wanted to get in there and mix it up.
You don't want to be the guy sitting inside or in the dugout when something happens. But usually in the baseball stuff, they're trying to pull guys apart. Rarely do you see, I mean, unless it's super, there's been a history, and sometimes it's just better to just let it go and hopefully they can figure it out. But with the bats and the cleats,
Jesus.
And people being on the bottom, it's amazing some bad things haven't happened. Or maybe they have, I just haven't heard.
That's the philosophy I live by my whole life. Just let them go. Walk away, Jim.
Yeah.
The fuck out of there.
The last fight you were in, you won by 5 blocks.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, as long as what'd you always say, Russ? As long as you can run faster than the guy behind you, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, Neil Fernie, thanks. Neil Hiltz, I think his name is. Ty at the favorite rink. And Steve, I think it's Schechtel. Thanks, Steve. And Rick T. Bears, who's a big fan. He asked an interesting question here that I'll get to in a sec. Mick the Hound. Louis, a DJ Beatface. What a handle that is. DJ Beatface.
DJ Beatface?
Yeah. A lad named Stu and Rich Decision 1. Russ, he wants to know if the road trips were what had a lot to do. You had mentioned this earlier, but was that a consideration when you retired, that you got the road trips were too much?
No. It wasn't that at all.
Yeah, you love road trips.
Well, it's when your team can be together. Obviously, we all love our families, but when you're on the road, it's just the guys and you're having dinners together, you're playing, you're not worried about your kids, your wife has got the kids, and the guys are just enjoying the camaraderie, the fun, and hopefully if you're winning on the road, if you're on a good team, it's a blast. If you're weak, it sucks because you're just getting pounded. But
right.
The road was fun. I mean, to me, that was part of the game. And unfortunately, at the end of my career, they started chartering, and then we didn't spend as much time in some of the cities. We'd play a game and leave, and then you're really just living in hotels.
Right.
But when we flew commercially, we spent a lot of time in the cities and got to enjoy them.
Pat, you play in the sport of baseball where one of the most quotable quotes ever from the book Ball 4, and I'm sure you know this. It swept the world. It's viral. It still is. When they'd asked, of course, baseball has the longest road trips ever. I mean, they're horrendous playing night after night. And they asked the guy, what's the toughest part of being on those long road trips? And the guy said, coming home and pretending you're horny. I find that very difficult.
I heard that quote. That's hilarious.
Yeah, hilarious quote. That did that have some, Pat, those road trips for you? I would think for a baseball player, it must just be such a long, horrendous season. What is it, 162 games or something in the majors? And obviously half of those are on the road.
Yeah, you know, and this may sound odd, but it's amazing what you get used to. It's the off days on the road that are very odd and strange. You just get used to playing every night. And, you know, Russ touched on something about the team dinners, and that really is the best part of being on the road, where, you know, guys don't have young kids at home. They can everyone's together. And I feel for the new generation of sports where guys just don't have the freedom to do those things anymore because of the social media and stuff. And, you know, guys just, I don't think they hang out as much. And I think that's just too bad. And, unfortunately, they're just missing out on some really good times and building relationships and so on, because I'm sure Russ would say the same thing. That's the part you miss. And if that's not a part of the program, because, you know, you can't be out, you know, with the way things are, it's too bad.
Who was your most favorite teammate, Pat? And Russ, you can think about that too. And maybe a story about him if you do. One of your most favorite guys in your baseball career.
I mean, the guy that I played with for quite a long time, possible Hall of Famer, Chase Utley, ended his career with the Dodgers. Phenomenal player. All the baseball parts is, you know, you can go through all the stats and it's pretty impressive, but probably the most mentally tough player. The things he would do to prepare, the way he played the game. Every second he was on the field, it was everything he had. And it was just impressive to see.
Give us an idea of how he would prep for a game that others wouldn't do the same thing.
Well, the amount of video stuff was insane. And he would just sit and watch and look for patterns. And when I say patterns, pitchers' patterns about what they're going to throw him. And he was tough, too, for a baseball player. You know, he's kind of famous now for that slide he did into second base in New York where he broke the guy's femur. They changed the rules about sliding because of him.
Right.
And I had already been retired, and I called him and I said, hey, you know, you can't just go breaking up double plays and hip high.
Right.
And his answer was, can you believe that motherfucker tried to give me a concussion? And I just sat down the phone and I go, you know, because he bounced off the player and hit his head. And that's what it was. And that I hope he doesn't mind me saying it, but that's who he is. I mean, he's tough. A tough son of a bitch.
Balls to the wall was this guy.
Yeah, he would try to, on plays at the, it's hard to explain, and but if there's a man on third base, a lot of times if a hitter hits a ground ball, the throw will come home.
Right.
And for a left-handed hitter like him, if he hits a ball to first base, that sometimes that throw can be in line with him running to first base, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah.
And we had just gotten browbeaten over this team meeting about not getting a guy in from third. And, you know, we got to hit the ball in the air and let, you know, for a sack fly. We're hitting too many ground balls, and they're cutting off the run at home, and we're losing games, basically was the message. So we're in Atlanta, and, you know, it was right after this, and he topped a ball to first base, and instead of running down the line of the where the chalk is, he veered into the field and jumped up in the air to try to have the ball hit him.
Oh, no kidding.
And the first baseman sailed it over the catcher's head. It went off the back screen. The guy was safe. And I was up to bat. And the catcher goes, did he just... I go, yeah, he did. He did. And I can't believe they didn't call him out.
Yeah. That's funny, man. Yeah. They got to mic up you guys. They got to mic up the ball players, man.
How about you, Rusty, before we go?
My favorite teammate was Wendell Clark, and we were both young, and Wendell came in, and he kicked the crap out of everybody, and we ended up playing together for a couple of years until he got hurt, and then I got traded, but we, on and off the ice, we were as tight could be, and he came in, and he was so freaking tough that if somebody was screwing with me, he'd say, Russ, after the whistle, if somebody's on you, count to three. And if I'm not there in 3 seconds, I'm fighting somebody else. You're on your own. And he was so tough that one game, he was beating the shit out of Bob Probert at center ice. And Basil McRae had me in a headlock. And Basil's massive. And I was like maybe 178 pounds soaking wet at the time. And Basil's choking me. He's not going to fight me, but he's choking me. And Wendell Clark's beating up Bob Probert, saying and talking to Basil as he's punching him in the face like this.
Wow.
And he says, Basil, if you don't let go of him, when I'm done with this piece of shit, I'm going to fucking kill you. And Basil let me go. And that's how tough this guy was. And he was not a big guy.
No, he fucking wasn't.
5'10", 180 pounds. And he pounded the shit out of everybody. And then
Probert was huge.
Huge. And then Proby beat the crap. And Probert beat the shit out of Wendell once when Wendell hurt his back. And he hurt it a couple of years later. And he just didn't have the strength. But he got rehabbed and came back. And he had a great career. But Clarkie and I had a good time. We're both kind of learning the ropes and of the league, and we played together at a school in Saskatchewan called Notre Dame. And he was a first year midget, and I was second year. So he was 15, I was 16, and then a few years later, we got to play together. So we had a relationship, and then it grew once we hit pro together. And Clarkie was just awesome. Like he got a standing ovation when he broke the rookie record for goals in Toronto. And the place is going nuts. And I'm sitting beside him on the bench. And he goes, I'd rather fight than score any day.
No kidding.
And then off the ice, we'd be out at bars, right? And all these big tough guys would come over and they'd talk to me. And they'd say, why is he so tough? He's not that big. You know, and then you could see, I should take a run at him or something like that. Fuck. And I'm like, are you fucking dumb?
Yeah.
He'll kill you. And then, and Clarkie was so mellow off the ice because his mom, he grew up with his mom, was the school teacher at the school he went to.
Right.
And they were not allowed to fight at school. So he fought on the ice, not off the ice.
So it was like a freedom for him out there.
Absolutely. And when he got on the ice, he had permission to beat the shit out of people if he wanted.
So he's got years and years pent up.
Oh my
God!
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fuck. I've seen him hit a guy 3 times for 27 stitches. Hit him 3 times. Kevin McGuire in training camp. He hit him with the right and went right, backhand, forehand, and he cut him 3 different places for 27 stitches. It was the grossest thing I've ever seen, and I almost puked because it was like somebody punching a watermelon. That's the sound it made going through a watermelon. It was gross.
It must have amazed you, Russ, when you when you broke into the league, if someone told you, this guy's our fighter, but he's never fought before off the ice, you'd probably go, you can't do that to the guy. And yet Clarkie was that guy.
Once he got to junior and you were allowed to fight, then he beat the shit out of everybody. But when I played with him in midget, he never fought once because we weren't allowed.
Did you know that it was in there?
I didn't know till I heard about. I knew how hard he could hit. Like, he was mean and tough on the ice as a 15-year-old kid. And then when he came as an 18-year-old, he had man strength, and he was only 18 years old, and he just fucking annihilated people. It was awesome.
Jeez.
Well, this is great, boys. Pat, here's a toughie, Pat, before you go.
Sure.
Someone's asking, what's the biggest misconception of athletes? I said, I don't know.
Ooh, that's a hell of a question.
I don't know. It's a good way to end the show. No one knows. Take that question away. Who is that?
Well, I'll throw my 2 cents in.
Okay.
Athletes are human beings.
Yeah.
And there's good people and bad people in all walks of life and sports, or you know, that it's publicized when somebody makes a mistake. Well, that stuff goes on in every day regular life.
Walk
and
of
it's
life,
just yeah. that every walk of life, but because athletes are in the media, it's, you know, it's in the media and we read about it or we see it. But athletes are no different than any other person, that, you know, there's good and there's more good than there is bad. And and they just unfortunately glorify when somebody makes a mistake, I think.
I couldn't agree more. And I just to add too, I think about this all the time. They're always, baseball is starving for a personality to, you know, basketball has all these personalities, football. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the perception might be that, you know, everybody wants to be the big focus of attention. And, you know, there are players out there that just want to play and that didn't ask for all the fame and the notoriety and the attention, that that just want to play the game. And, you know, I don't think the fan ever thinks about that, where you just want to, and maybe it's not possible, but you know, there are guys that want to live a somewhat normal life and also do the thing they love. And mm-hmm. a lot of times that's hard to do.
That is an absolutely fantastic answer. Yeah. Isn't that something? Because I fell into that category. Everyone wants to be the hero, you know? Everyone wants to be the hero.
Yeah.
Pat, how much, I mean, how much, and then we got to go, how much have you possibly learned today that we've crammed into your head of pure intelligence, the whole show?
The thing is, I'm up here with, like, all these great hockey players, and I don't know much about the sport. And one of the things I'm fascinated by was the sticks. I just assumed they all got the same sticks. I didn't have any idea that there was competition. They were paying for them, and they were, you know, some are wood and some aren't. I mean, it's fascinating to me because I just didn't know. I mean, you would think they're managing this puck that's frozen and it's flying all around. You better have something that can maneuver it pretty good.
Yeah. Well, off air, because we got to wrap up, get Russ to tell you about some of the mean things he could do with a stick, okay? He'll explain to you.
All oh, boy.
Rusty, good job. We got, it was a two or three White Claw. I'll tell you what, Pat, that's a huge show.
Two Pellegrinos for me.
Yeah. Two Pellies and three Claws.
Yeah, and four packs of darts. Yeah, and four packs of darts. Boys, thanks a lot, Pat. We really, really appreciate you taking the time to do this. We know you're busy and you're trying to move into a house there and stuff. And, Bob, you're just a wonderful guy. That was terrific. I really, really enjoyed the past hour, man. Thanks a lot, Squirrely.
Jim, my pleasure. Thank you.
What's your nickname?
They call me the Bat up here.
Pat the Bat.
Pat the Bat.
But it's got nothing to do with baseball or any other thing that people might think. It's when I was in college.
let's stop right there.
Just go with it, Pat. Just say.
Tell.
The Latin guys, I went to Miami, so the Latin guys kept calling me something. I couldn't figure out what the hell they were calling me, and whatever a bat is in Spanish, they were calling me, and I think it's ratón, maybe. Anyone know? Somebody will know.
Yeah.
And I go, what the hell is that? What is that? And they go, man, you never sleep at night. You're out on the streets.
That's good.
So the Pat the Bat has nothing to do with baseball.
That's good.
Yeah. Pat the Bat stays up. He can hang himself upside down all night long.
It was Pat the Splat against Smoltz, though, I can tell you that.
There you go, man. Thanks a lot, Pat. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We missed all our... We're on Facebook at The Suspendables. Our email is thesuspendables@yahoo.com. Check us out, and there'll be a bunch of stuff on there about Pat. And, boy, this may take us over the top. All these interviews, we got all these sharp guys. Pat, you have a good week. Rusty, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, pal.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Suspendables. See you later, boys.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Cortnell in Los Angeles. A new episode every Wednesday on Wooshka, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, we appreciate you sharing the show with your followers and friends.